Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's April 21st, 2015 8th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 9, Co-Invest Structures and Issues, Seeding Managers and Hedge Fund Trends. Richard Goldman, Steve Terrell, and Steve Giordano will discuss co-invest vehicles and issues, seeding managers and hedge fund trends. Now, on to the podcast.
To my left here is my partner, Steve Giordano, who'll be talking about co-invest vehicles. And to my right here is my partner, Rich Goldman, who is the co-head of our hedge fund practice. He'll be talking about seeding managers, and I'll follow up with hedge fund trends. So to kick things off, I'll kick it over to Steve.
Thanks, Steve. So I'm going to discuss today the co-invest vehicles. I'm sure everyone has read or heard a lot about this in the hedge fund space. It's not a new phenomena, but it's something that has been catching a lot of press lately, as well as a lot of activity in the marketplace. We spend most of our time up here with hedge funds, and we can say in the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen a huge increase in the amount of co-invest vehicles that are out there. So the biggest question we have, because we're going to skip over what are co-invest vehicles, is essentially that's just any type of vehicle the manager wants to put together. But really the big question that we get asked a lot is, why is there such an uptick in the use of co-investment vehicles? And there's a lot of theories out there, and I think some of them are very, very relevant to this. One main one being side pocket investments. Since the 2008 crisis, side pockets have developed into a somewhat negative view, perception in the marketplace. So you're seeing a lot of funds today either reduce their side pocket exposure or not have side pockets at all or have opt-in, opt-out features. So we think the evolution of the co-invest vehicle is an outburst of what's going on with the lack of side pockets in the funds. But in addition to that, you're also seeing managers pursue an investment thesis that goes beyond their limitations in their fund via concentration limits, capacity limitations, best ideas. So we're seeing that outsized position being better suited for additional capital in parallel with the fund. And you're also seeing managers show their expertise, showing themselves that they can separate from the pack. The hedge fund space has become a very crowded market over the years. And how do you separate oneself from another is through these special deals. You can not only show yourself running a great portfolio, but you can also put on display some of your best ideas. And then finally, it's like we believe it's a creation of goodwill and an ability to raise more capital. Goodwill being, you have a lot of investors who come to you that want to participate in your fund, but also get that special access. And that's one way a manager can deal with that. The next big question we get on co-invest vehicles is generally what type of terms we're seeing. And I'm going to hit three main ones. And that's the fees and the lockup. Management fees can vary across the board as well as the performance fees. There was a recent Wall Street Journal article, I think 2 days ago, that talked about how there's big discounts of fees. If a manager's running at 2%, they may drop it to 1%. I think that's partly true. I think you have to look at the reason for the co-invest to determine what type of fee people are going to charge. For example, if it's a high conviction idea, I think managers will go out and charge a high fee for it because it's such a good idea and it's going to be a profitable idea. If it's an idea that requires excess capital needs, that's where a manager will likely drop the fees to a low level basis, if no fee at all, because they just want to get the deal into their main pool and then give access and be able to do that deal through access through this co-invest vehicle. And then there's just strategy enhancements, and that's where you see usually a reasonable discount to the fees that the manager charges the fund itself. But again, these are all over the board, and some of the larger funds or emerging manager funds, I should say, will have side letters with investors that may spell out these fees, so they may be predetermined as to what fees they can charge. On the performance side, it varies even more widely than the management fee side. And the performance varies. You can have something from a rate that's lower than the 20%. It could be down to 5%, 10%, or nothing. You can see use of the traditional hedge fund model on the fee and how do you calculate it. That is realized, unrealized. What we're seeing a lot today is for the special concentrated one-off type of deals, you're seeing a private equity-like model on a pure realization basis. And if it flips into a public security, Even if there isn't a realization basis, they may do a distribution in kind or try to get liquidity for that investor. And at that point, if it's a distribution in kind, they'll measure it on a unrealized basis methodology. And that's a hybrid approach you can see quite often. In terms of the length of these co-invest vehicles, again, that can vary depending on the type of deal that you're going to get involved with. They can be almost indefinite terms with a hope that there's going to be liquidity at the end. It could be a limitation based on securities law restrictions. But in general, you're seeing 2 to 4 years on a typical term. That's on the business side. Now, on the regulatory conflict side, managers who want to play in this space do have to be conscious of any of the regulatory concerns that are out there, as well as conflicts. On the regulatory side, you want to examine your trade allocation policies, which may require you to go take a look back at your compliance manual to see how you're going to allocate trades. You want to look at your current disclosure in your PPMs. Make sure that you have adequate conflicts disclosed in there, adequate disclosure regarding investments, managing investment pools that may trade and act just like your hedge fund or on a concentrated basis, and that may take different positions or trade at a different time than the fund itself. You also want to look at, from a conflict perspective, just dealing with practically, besides the disclosure, is dealing with different investors' liquidity. The hedge fund may have more frequent liquidity and may cause pressure, downward pressure on the manager to do something with this illiquid investment if it's in the side pocket, if it's not in the side pocket, but in a co-invest vehicle. You want to look at the difference in transparency. When you do a co-invest vehicle, a lot of the investors in that vehicle may have greater access to information. Because going into one of these co-invest vehicles with a special idea or a special transaction, many times the managers will ask the investors to sign an NDA. And that NDA is going to give them more access into information that they would normally get if they were in the hedge fund itself. And then transacting in the same security. The hedge fund, as I just mentioned, may have a need or desire to trade around a position while you have it in the co-invest vehicle. And you want to be very conscious about, you know, changing the market, front running, and the like. So managers really have to sit back and take a look and examine their own internal policies to make sure that they are equipped to handle these co-invest vehicles. And then the last item I'd like to hit on this is the trends. Where we're seeing co-invest vehicles go? Well, we're seeing them for activist strategies. We're seeing them for distressed credit strategies, real estate, and best ideas. It all enhances what a manager could be doing in their fund and giving a special opportunity to the investors that they have in their fund today.
Thanks, Steve. We're going to switch gears. I think co-investments are typically more prevalent in more established managers. I'm going to take a few minutes and talk to you about seeding arrangements. And we're seeing that a significant percentage of new managers launching funds are doing so with the benefit of seed capital or founders capital, like money from PAMCO. We're seeing a proliferation of high quality seeders, which is a good thing because we're seeing a lot more money in the marketplace, and that seed capital is actually coming in on more reasonable terms than it used to be when the quality of the seeders might not have been as robust. There is a growing tension between seed capital and founders capital as investors in founders class shares are being a bit more aggressive and wanting to get the same kind of terms as a seed capital investor might get. There are several distinctions between a seeder and a founders class investor. Typically, the seeder will put in more capital and will be locked up for a longer period of time. But the seeder will also get back either equity in the management company, which we would consider to be a net deal, or more likely, they will get a revenue share, which means a percentage of the gross revenue. As I mentioned, we are seeing far more revenue share deals for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that they're less complicated. In that situation where you're taking a percentage of the gross, you don't have to worry about how the manager is spending its money or how the manager is running its business. Well, I guess you still have to be concerned with some respect how they're running the business, but because you're not netting out the expenses in terms of your percentage, a gross deal seems to be less complicated and seems to be more popular. The first question that we are always asked is how much money can we expect to raise from a seeder and how much capital what percentage of our company are we going to have to give up? I'll distinguish the two between high-quality launchers and lower-quality launchers, and they're often distinguished based on several factors: the pedigree of the manager, the chances of success of the manager, the team that the manager has assembled, and of course the seeder that they're able to attract. For higher quality launches, we're seeing seeding in the range of $75 million to $200 million with a revenue share of about 15 to 30%. On the net side, those percentages are a little bit higher. On the next tier down, sort of smaller seed launches, we're seeing those in the range of 25 to 50 million. And interestingly enough, although the capital invested is smaller, the percentages in those lower tier seed arrangements are typically higher. We're also seeing many new and interesting types of seeders in the marketplace beyond just the traditional private equity managers. We're seeing family offices, funds of funds, and we're also seeing large hedge fund managers that are looking to diversify, that are looking to become more institutional, and they can bring a lot to the table. Those kind of deals are more like a joint venture than they are seed capital. But in that situation, the new manager can come on board, doesn't have to really worry about running all aspects of a business like legal, compliance, accounting, marketing. And it also gives the more established manager access to a new team and maybe some fresh ideas. Let's cover some terms of a typical seed deal, and it's sort of an oxymoron because I don't think there really is a typical seed deal. And those deals are structured generally to meet the needs of the seeders themselves. But seed capital is typically locked up longer than founder's share would be locked up, or obviously than regular investors. We're seeing on average roughly 3 years, a three-year lockup before the seeder can withdraw its capital. And they can also withdraw sooner for certain events, including poor performance of the manager, or maybe some bad acts involving either a key person departure, or maybe it's an SEC violation. After the three-year period, most seed deals will permit the seeder to take its money out and not be penalized for that, although we are seeing more seed deals where whenever the seeder takes out its capital, its ownership percentage will be ratcheted back. Most deals have the seeders paying full fees as opposed to the founders, which pay a discounted fee, but the seeders are getting their discount by way of their revenue share. So if they're paying 100 cents on the dollar and they've got a 25% revenue share, their effective rate is essentially 75 cents on the dollar. Control is often a topic of discussion and much negotiation. As you might imagine, control is more of an issue in a net deal where you're taking a true equity ownership in the manager and where you're sharing in the net revenue. The control relates to things like governance and how expenses are spent. Another area that is open for much discussion has to do with buyout rights, and that will depend on your seeder. Traditional private equity seeders are looking for an exit in 5 to 7 years. So you typically see a put-call provision in the range of 5 to 7 years. The buyout price is typically very high and can sometimes be negotiated when the seeder elects to put its capital. But we're often seeing deals that are structured as a percentage of average revenue multiplied times some multiple of, let's say, 3 to 5. Of course, you'll see in seeding arrangements, and you'll probably see in founders class, provisions such as MFN, enhanced reporting, and capacity rights. Interestingly, on the MFN, you have to be careful to make sure that you carve out of the MFN some of the special terms that you're giving to the seeder. If the seeder is stuck to a three-year lockup, and other investors have a one-year lockup, there's a reason for that. And so you want to make sure that you carve that out of the MFN. Quickly, just a couple more items to cover. Seeders will typically get a similar percentage or the same percentage equity or revenue share stake in other funds that are launched by the manager. Essentially, the philosophy is we've put you in business, and as you continue to grow, we're going to participate in the various products that you launch. At a minimum, we see that happening where funds are launched with substantially the same strategy. The principals in the fund or the manager that is being seeded will have many restrictions. They will be required to reinvest a substantial portion of their performance allocation back into the fund, and they will be subject to non-competition restrictions that typically run from 1 year to 18 months, so that if the manager decides to shut down its funds, it's not going to turn around and just restart that business without the seeder having any interest in it. Finally, these deals, we try to structure them on a tax-efficient basis. If there's a foreign seeder, there may be some concerns about effectively connected income. And also, there are ways for a seeder to be able to take the management fee and even the performance compensation as maybe a special limited partner in the fund so that they're able to get the benefit of capital gains treatment and not have it treated as ordinary income.
Thanks, Rich. As I mentioned before, I was following up two great presentations here. So it's not going to be any surprise that a lot of what I'm going to talk about has to do with both co-invest vehicles and some seeding arrangements. So when you talk about hedge fund trends, I think people tend to get a little myopic. In fact, I'm going to talk about the hedge fund trends that I see and how my practice is developing along with my clients. What I continue to see is large managers continue to capture AUM. That's not universal. It's not across the board. But even I think Jane alluded to that in what she was saying earlier. You know, she's seeing less and less competition for what they do. That's a trend in the market. So the larger clients that have the operational capability, they're more institutional-like, I think, and they end up going through a lot more rigorous due diligence requests over a period of time and get the larger allocations. But that's not to say that there isn't opportunities out there for emerging managers and sort of mid-tier managers. But by and large, what I've been seeing is the bigger capital outlays are going to the larger institutional-like managers. But that doesn't mean it's a seller's market, because, and what I mean by that is, the investors are still driving demand here. They're driving demand on many different levels, including pressure on fees. It's not that the 2 and 20 model is gone, but you see it less and less. And in fact, if you're going to demand or offer the 2 and 20 model, you're going through a lot more hoops with your investors to justify that in terms of strategy, in terms of resources, et cetera. A liquidity alignment. We'd sit down with a client and say, okay, what's your strategy? What's your liquidity? What do you want to offer your liquidity? You have the push and pull between the manager who wants to say, well, you know, I want a long lockup versus investor who they're talking and saying, I want quarterly or even monthly. So the new launches that I'm seeing now have a big liquidity alignment with the portfolio, more so than in recent years. I mean, you still have the terms where you have the gates and the holdbacks and the suspensions, but more and more we're seeing more and more liquidity aligned with what the actual strategy is. Increased transparency. Investors are always looking for increased transparency, and Steve touched on it earlier in his presentation about co-invest vehicles and what investors are demanding there. They're demanding increased transparency, not only in the main funds, but that's coming over from the co-invest vehicles and the other types of fund vehicles that the managers are adding on to their current portfolio. The last is a better alignment of investment strategies, investor goals. Investors are saying, hey, you know what? This particular strategy that you have may have in a main fund, I like it, but it doesn't really suit my current portfolio. Why don't we take a sliver of that? Why can't I get a little bit of exposure to that rather than to the entire strategy? And because of that, and because of these investor demands, we're seeing more and more customized fund products. The managers are looking to penetrate more into their existing client base, and they're also seeking to address their client sort of demands. So whether it's a manager-driven product or whether it's an investor-driven product where they come to the manager and say, like I mentioned earlier, hey, we like this strategy. You're doing a global bond portfolio, but we only want access or exposure to the European side of that. How can we manage that? So we're seeing more and more of those types of fund products come out. Also along with that is the single investment funds. More and more managers looking for yield in this market have turned to, as Steve mentioned earlier, sort of less liquid type of ideas. So they've turned to the single investment funds where they put their sort of best idea into a fund and go out to their existing investors. And they're finding appetite with their existing investment base to move away a little bit from their hedge fund strategy into a less liquid portfolio where in some instances it's because they're on the side pockets that Steve mentioned earlier or because they don't want to put the idea into the main portfolio. We're also seeing hybrid funds. More and more managers are putting together sort of that aspect and the thinking that went into the single investment funds into the hybrid funds. They'll take their liquid strategy and their illiquid strategy and put them into one vehicle. Now, sometimes, obviously, there are aspects in the structuring that you got to consider, whether there's ring fencing of liabilities, if you're going to do it in a class, if you're going to do it in a full class basis on the U.S. side or sort of a segregated portfolio on the offshore side. Some of them are doing in that aspect. Others are saying, you know what, this is our first product, we're going to put them all together, and we've done a couple of those recently. Interestingly enough, that's being driven not only on the hedge fund side from pure hedge fund managers, but also the PE side, where previously managers that have only been on the private equity side want to introduce a bit of liquid strategy into their products. We're also seeing more and more managers, again, in a hunt for yield, turning the single investment funds into a full-blown private equity strategy, moving more towards that aspect of it and diversifying their business, so to speak. Again, driven by investor demand. What I'm seeing other is add-on funds, what I call add-on funds. And again, that's the strategies where an investor says, I like the strategy, but I only want a sliver of it. So I call that an add-on fund, where they have the global bond fund, and then you have the European bond fund, which is trades pari passu, but only in the European strategy. Finally, I'm seeing more interest in liquid alt funds. I think Jane mentioned also on the hedge fund to fund manager side, we're seeing more and more customized products. Obviously, moving more towards sort of the single investment funds into individual managers, but also using SMAs creatively and other sort of pooled investment structures. Taking on what Rich was saying earlier, we're seeing more established managers considering joint ventures and seed capital arrangements. And I think that has to do a little bit of what the proliferation of the founders class has been. It wasn't 5 years ago or so, you wouldn't see that many founders class funds. Now, everybody that is managing, the first thing they say was, we want a founders class. They'll come to you and say, we're looking at a founders class at 50 million, 75 million, 100 million, whatever that is. And from there, I think managers have broadened that out a little bit to consider other sort of arrangements with investors, whether they be typical founders class, which you'd call founders class investors, or later stage investors that can come in and seed a portion of their business. Rich talked about seeding arrangements where the manager was coming out. These are arrangements where I'm seeing institutional-like managers starting a new product, and they'll go to one of their investors, and they'll have a seed arrangement for that particular fund or the next particular product. So we're seeing even the larger managers get creative in that aspect of their business. So finally, I want to bring up one topic that we haven't been seeing, or one trend that we haven't been seeing. We haven't seen any managers, or very few managers, relying on the new 506C to engage in general solicitation. Now, I'm not sure why that is, whether it's the regulatory burden, whether it's because not many institutional-like quality managers are relying on 506C, but we're not seeing very many of those launches.
One follow-up question for both Rich and Steve on the transparency piece, because you're going to hear a lot of that in this marketplace. And in light of our administrators today can provide real data very quickly, what are we seeing on managers on really trying to provide more transparency, especially with the sophisticated client bases that are more in tune to ask for it, but others not asking for it, and this obviously need to be consistent across the board?
I think our best practice that we're seeing is that if institutional investors are asking for it, then our managers are comfortable giving it out to other investors. Even though most documents will permit managers to be selective in their disclosure, I think they recognize that it's not best practice. The SEC would not view it favorably, and it's not a great investor relations situation. So unless there's a real regulatory need, or maybe sometimes information will be provided to a risk aggregator where the specific information is not disclosed, I think the general practice is if somebody needs it, we'll offer it up to everybody.
And I concur with that. In fact, some funds are coming right out of the gate with a risk aggregator as a partner to provide that information to all of their investors. Right.
I think there was a recent article written that ranked hedge funds based on their overall, investor friendliness and the like. And it was interesting to see some of the largest names were actually some of the worst on the transparency, even though they have very strong due diligence, very strong internal organizations, but they were the lowest on the transparency side. And I think that might be in part to this conflict that managers have about their best ideas, how they offer their products out, and to be able to maneuver in the marketplace, but balancing those needs out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2015 8th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan, Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan, Lewis & its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.